evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 5th, 2015. South Sudan's warring parties blame each other for more fighting in Upper Nile.
The other attack in Nasir, the rebels started shelling Nasir on the 31st of December, on the 1st, the 2nd and the 3rd.
And Central Equatoria State Governor appoints new ministers in a cabinet reshuffle.
For example, what is the point of relieving the deputy governor and then appointing him? Or what is the point of relieving the other ministers who retain their positions? The normal thing that would have happened is relieve those ministers who are completely removed from the cabinet and then relieve those who have swapped positions and then reappoint them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. There are reports of fresh fighting between government and rebel forces in Unity State and Upper Nile. Lucy Pony has this report.
The South Sudanese Army and rebel forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar are blaming each other for the latest outbreak of fighting in Unity State. Army spokesman Philip Aguer said rebels launched attacks on SPLA positions in one of South Sudan's main oil fields near the Unity State capital, Bentiu.
Yesterday, the rebels shelled SPLA position in Unity Oil Field, more than 10 miles north of Bentiu town. They shelled that place yesterday at 10 o'clock in the morning and in the evening, and this morning at 4 a.m.
Colonel Aguer said the latest rebel attack was in clear violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in January last year. He says his office has not yet had a report on whether there were any casualties in the fighting and how much damage occurred. Meanwhile, Lul Roy Kong, the military spokesman for Machar's rebel group, says government forces started the fighting in Unity State.
What had happened yesterday was that they attacked our positions in Panakwach, and we dropped them back, and they retreated. And by evening yesterday, we took control of oil fields. So there was just new fighting in oil fields because they wanted to recapture oil fields from our forces. As of yesterday evening at around 9, the last engagement was at Kilo 15, which is exactly about 15 kilometers east of Bentiu town. That was the last information I had yesterday.
Kong says the rebels are now in control of the Unity oil field and Kilo 15. Like Aguer, he says he is unable to provide any casualty figures because he is still waiting to get a report from the field about the fighting. Both Kong and Aguer say there has also been fighting in South Sudan's other oil-producing state, Upper Nile. Aguer says the SPLA and rebel fighters skirmished in Upper Nile on Saturday.
The other attack in Nasir, the rebels started shelling Nasir on the 31st of December, on the 1st, the 2nd and the 3rd, and there were clash of the patrolling.
Aguer says 8 people were killed during that attack, including 2 SPLA officers and 6 commanders from the rebel side. 4 people were wounded, and the SPLA seized 6 AK-47 rifles and 1 rocket launcher from the rebels, Aguer says. But Kong says government forces started the fighting in Upper Nile. He says SPLA soldiers attacked Thuk, Haipur Buab and Ketbek, but were driven back by the rebels. He says attacks by SPLA soldiers are not uncommon.
They wanted to steal some cereals from the civilians and some livestock. The problem with the occupying force in Nasir is that they do not have combat service support. In other words, they lack logistics, and from time to time, they would venture out to go and steal food.
The Anglican Bishop of Renk Diocese in Upper Nile, Joseph Garang Atem, confirmed that there were clashes in Nasir over the weekend. He says the fighting in Nasir was very heavy.
Yeah, that is true. And that is what we had, actually, very, very, very heavy shelling from the rebels to Nasir. So, actually, that is happened. And even 2 days ago or 3 days ago, there are some, they try in order to do shooting between Jodah and Halaga.
Many residents of Reng fled their homes when fighting first erupted there in September last year, Garang says. He says ordinary South Sudanese are living in fear now as the fighting that began on December 15, 2013, goes into a second year. He says the fighting has paralyzed many activities, including education and farming.
We are depending on agriculture. Everybody go to agriculture area to cultivate. And that is the hope of everybody. But because of the war, many people, they give up because of insecurity. Many children, they left, and the teachers, they left. But you know the challenge, how are you going to operate to take the risk of the life of the children in order to be at the school?
Garang says if the fighting continues, many people will face hunger. He says the warring parties need to quickly find a peaceful solution to the conflict. Talks mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, to try to end the fighting were adjourned last month. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
Waki Simon Wudu and Michael Atit contributed to that report. Central Equatorial State Parliament today formed a committee to vet the new cabinet appointed by Governor Clement Conga last week. The committee will scrutinize the appointees' qualification and experience for their new posts. Waki Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
The committee was formed through a resolution approved by State Assembly lawmakers during a recent emergency session convened by Parliament leadership. Today's meeting was aimed at validating Governor Clement Wani Konga's decision last week to dissolve the entire state government. Alfred Kerry Yokwe is the deputy speaker of the state legislature and chaired the session. After the governor's decree was seconded by the House and the select committee's terms of reference were defined, he made this ruling.
Please, the committee, I expect you to do your job and come up with the recommendations necessary for us.
The committee was given 2 days to finish the vetting process and report back to the leadership of the parliament on Thursday. Among the directives passed by the House was for the select committee to examine academic qualifications of the executive appointees and to assess their integrity and work experience. Meanwhile, the issue of representation in the cabinet from all 6 counties of the state was a source of major concern and debate during the session. Some members insisted that as long as the appointees are all well qualified and prepared to take on their new posts, it does not matter which county they hail from. Others disagree. Honorable Francis Dabe represents Kajukeji County. He says Article 106 of the State Transitional Constitution mandates the establishment of a well-balanced cabinet which has the elements of inclusivity, competency, integrity, gender and ethnic diversity. Therefore, he says,
we cannot in any way bring a good number of members of Council of Ministers from one county or from one locality. If we want to address the issue of unity, this again must also be put as terms of reference.
Konga dissolved his entire cabinet on Wednesday with very few changes in the leadership. 3 ministers were fired, but the rest were retained. Some merely swapped positions. Konga also dissolved his cabinet in September 2013, some 2 years after it was established. Many legislators have challenged his decision, saying it's illegal and that it will have a significant monetary implication on the state. Jacob Aligo is a legislator in the parliament and an ex-minister of finance who was removed from that position in 2013. He says that legally the post holders should receive 2 years post-service benefit after 5 years in office. By constantly dissolving the government, Aligo contends several ministers who have swapped positions since 2010 are likely to be paid double or more than the mandated 2-year post-service benefits.
These things really has to be changed. For example, what is the point of relieving the deputy governor and then appointing him? Or what is the point of relieving the other ministers who retain their positions? The normal thing that would have happened is to relieve those ministers who are completely removed from the cabinet, and then they leave those who have swapped positions and then reappoint them and appoint the new ones. So that next time we cannot talk of vacuum.
Aligo warns that the dissolution of the cabinet could lead to a power vacuum, which poses a great challenge to the state with regards to service delivery. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Udo from Juba.
Still in Juba, South Sudan's health sector has received a big financial boost to fuel the country's fight against the spread of communicable diseases, thanks to recent grant from the Global Fund, an international financing organization that gathers and disburses additional resources to prevent and treat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. Mungome Debs Rakarinj has that story for VOA.
The Global Fund is giving South Sudan more than $100 million over the next 4 years to fight the spread of some of the most persistent, devastating communicable diseases in South Sudan and on the African continent. The Minister of Health's Director of International Coordination, Dr. Rule Rieck, says his office has received at least $250 million since 2004 to help the country deal with its many health challenges.
Through the Global Fund investments, we have made a very significant investment. That's are very, very important for reductions of maternal mortality and for reduction of the infant and under five mortality. Because through that investment, for the first time, the public health laboratory was opened, launched in July 8th, to improve the quality services delivery, especially the diagnostic part. And also specialized labs on TB and HIV.
South Sudan has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. It also has one of the world's highest maternal death rates. Dr. Rieck says too many mothers die in the hospital from easily treatable conditions.
They die first because of obstructed liver, that for whatever the reason, the liver cannot happen normally unless you've done cesarean section. The second leading cause of death is the bleeding. About 30% of the women, they die during the pregnancy or related, they die because of bleedings. And the bleedings, there's nothing you can do about it unless you do blood replacement. And for doing with blood replacement, you need to have a blood bank.
Rieck says, thanks to the Global Fund, the country now has a functional blood bank in Juba and another one in Malakal. With more funds coming, he says they will be able to open more blood banks in Yambio, Awil, Rumbek, and Torit. He says the money will also be used to treat and prevent the spread of malaria in the country. The funds will secure more than 7 million mosquito nets, which will be freely distributed to people throughout the country.
They will use some of the money also for setting up the capacities at the National Malaria Control Program by recruiting some of the healthcare workers at the national, at the state, and also some of them will be used also for institutional capacity to set up also offices in terms of the computer, the software, the tools that they will need and use for the monitoring and supervision of the malaria activities in the country.
Having trained health workers is one of the country's top priorities. Rieck says another is to educate the public about how to avoid preventable diseases. Habib Dafara directs South Sudan's HIV/AIDS Commission. He says South Sudanese have benefited from Global Fund monies since 2002, well before South Sudan became a country.
This funding is the one that has been supporting people mainly on drugs, mainly procuring the commodities, the ARVs, for the people who are in need of drugs. It has been also helping to put people on care, people, of course, who are chronically ill. And also, it has been helping facilities, availability and maintenance of equipment, say, for example, CD4 count machines.
Dafala says the South Sudan HIV/AIDS Commission has prepared a proposal seeking an additional $36 million, which he hopes will be released by June this year. He says the money will be used to treat HIV-positive patients over the next 3 years. Rieck says having high rates of diseases like malaria hurts the entire country's economy.
10 people die at any given time, at any city, anywhere in South Sudan. 4 of them, they die because of malaria. If they die in Juba, 4 of them die in malaria. If they die in Wau, 4 of them must have died because of malaria. If 10 people die in Torit, 4 people must have died because of malaria. It's any given time. If you also have 10 people admitted in any hospital in this country, 4 to 6 of them, they are in hospital admitted because of malaria. If you have also 10 people miss work, you guarantee 4 to 6 of them, they miss their works because of malaria.
Rick says a portion of any new funding received will be allocated to the Directorate of Primary Health Care to educate the public about malaria. Access to medicine is also a huge problem in South Sudan. Rick says the ministry is working with international humanitarian organizations to ensure that people living in conflict zones can receive adequate health care. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese lawmakers call for a constitutional amendment. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what sort of exercise do you engage in to stay healthy?
For me to stay healthy, every day I make sure that I went to gym and do physical exercises.
Well, in the past I was playing football, but currently I like running in the morning before I go to work. I run in the morning like for 1 hour. Then I do that, like 3 times, 4 times a week.
I do jogging, I do push-ups, I do squats, yeah.
I do athletics, cricket, and netball. Then the other thing I use it to run from morning from 6 to 7:30 around there.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Lawmakers in Sudan's ruling National Congress Party passed 3 controversial amendments to the country's constitution over the weekend. Under the new legislation, state governors will be appointed directly by President Omar Hassan al-Bashir instead of by popular vote. As VOA fellow Nabil Biagio reports, the amendments also grant extensive powers to the National Intelligence and Security Forces.
The 3 bills approved yesterday were introduced by President Omar al-Bashir. They allow the president to appoint all the state governors, expand security powers, and integrate Darfur's peace framework into the constitution, which includes the demand that all rebels lay down their weapons unconditionally. Member of Parliament Osman Nimer is with the National Congress ruling party. Nimer says the constitution gives the president the right to make any amendments to the constitution, including the right to appoint state governors. He says the 2nd bill is about the president's executive powers, and the 3rd one is about land laws. Nimer says in recent years, there have been problems with electing state governors by popular vote. He says ethnic disputes are common during the elections of governors because Sudan is a very diverse and what he calls tribalized country. Nimer says the change will strengthen national unity and avoid division and ethnic violence, and this must be written into the constitution. The changes also transform the National Intelligence and Security Forces, which originally were intended to be an information-gathering organization. Now they will be a military force on the same level as the country's army. And on the 3rd bill, the government says that since Sudan is facing intense insecurity in Darfur, southern Kordofan, and Blue Nile State, where government forces routinely battle rebel forces, there is a need to strengthen the security apparatus and expand its powers. But opposition lawmakers, such as Imad Bushara, who is with the Popular Congress Party, says the new amendments are unacceptable. He says, according to Sudan's interim constitution from 2005, the security is strictly supposed to gather and analyze information and consult with authorities like the police and the army. He says, under the new legislation, they become official forces tasked with defending the nation, a task, he says, belongs to the army. The new changes to Sudan's constitution allow the security forces to arrest citizens and conduct criminal investigation and even set up courts for trials, adding to the already expansive power security organizations already have. Bushara boycotted yesterday's vote. Bushara says we rejected all three amendments on principle because it deprives citizens and local governments of their basic rights. The new constitutional changes are not yet law, but simply a formality. Mr. Bashir is expected to sign them into law within days. They also come 4 months before he is running for his third term in office. Mr. Bashir has been president of Sudan for more than 25 years. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
We now turn to Nigeria. Boko Haram fighters have overpowered Nigerian soldiers at a military base in the far northeastern town of Baga, forcing residents and soldiers to flee. The military has not yet issued a statement about Saturday's attack, but sources tell VOA that Boko Haram has full control of the town. VOA's Anne Luke has the story with reporting in Maiduguri by Abdul Karim Haruna.
Boko Haram overran Baga after attacking a nearby village. One survivor told VOA that, quote, hundreds of insurgents rode into Baga on vehicles and motorbikes, some throwing explosives. They set fire to buildings. There was a fierce firefight. Soldiers resisted, quote, for hours, said an intelligence official in Maiduguri. But that source told VOA that without reinforcements, soldiers could not hold the town. Insurgents had blocked the main roads in or out. Residents fled into the bush or headed for Lake Chad to hop in canoes or try to swim away. Some drowned. Other residents were shot or injured. The number of dead and wounded is not known. A fisherman who got away told VOA that some soldiers were peeling off their uniforms and begging for civilian clothes. He said they appeared to have run out of ammunition. Baga is part of Senator Maina Maaji Lawan's district in Borno State. Baga is also his hometown.
They attacked the place by around between 5 and 6 in the morning. By 9, it was all over.
Senator Lawan said local and state authorities had informed the military of the Boko Haram threat in the area.
We were informed their locations and so on and so forth. Reports were made. I don't know. The ease with which it fell is really, really very, very, very disappointing.
There has been no official response to the attack. In the past, government officials have insisted the war covers a vast territory in the northeast and said the military cannot be everywhere at once. Boko Haram is known to attack military bases to resupply and rearm. But hoisting their black flag over Baga also struck a symbolic blow. The town sits on Lake Chad, whose waters straddle the borders of Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. The military base there was the nominal headquarters for a four-country joint task force set up last year to combat trafficking and terrorism. It appears only Nigerian troops were manning the base when it was attacked. Security analysts told VOA that the loss of Baga raises renewed concerns about the military's level of morale and preparedness. Soldiers in the northeast have complained they do not have adequate gear and ammunition to fight the insurgents. Local media report military tribunals have sentenced at least 70 soldiers to death for mutiny and refusing to fight. More are reportedly awaiting trial. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
Still in Nigeria, unrest on the border has disrupted the education of thousands of young people in Cameroon. Many Cameroonian schools on the border with Nigeria's Borno State have remained closed as other schools reopened today after Christmas break. Some schools were either destroyed by Boko Haram fighters or by Cameroonian Air Force units when they bombed villages seized by the suspected Boko Haram fighters last week. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Mbani Wilson, an official of Cameroon's Ministry of Basic Education in northern Cameroon, says thousands of teachers, students and pupils have fled schools located along the Cameroonian border with Nigeria's Borno State due to bloody confrontations between the Cameroon military and suspected militants of the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram.
It's a very difficult situation for learners and teachers as many of the schools, especially of the basic education sector, have been closed down. You see, a number of schools have been closed down. We face the attacks of Boko Haram and the constant fear of surprises.
19-year-old Fopa Faison, now an opposite student of the government's high school Marua in northern Cameroon, says he escaped when Cameroon's Air Force destroyed his old school on the border with Nigeria.
Praying that things should change so that we can still live our life here. Security has been really difficult. It has been very, very difficult for us.
Fopa's uncle, Alain Gaupwe, who also escaped from Ashigasha with his four children, says their school and huge portions of their town were destroyed by rockets launched by Cameroon's Air Force against suspected Boko Haram fighters who had occupied the area.
Nous allons continuer à travailler. Nous faisons confiance à nos hommes.
He says they still have confidence in the Cameroon military that is working to secure their home areas. Meanwhile, he says they expect their children to cope in their new environments. Maimunatu Farida, a student from Government Bilingual High School Marwa in Cameroon, says their classrooms are now congested with students fleeing the assaults in the border areas near Nigeria.
Nous restons solidaires avec nos camarades qu'ils pensent à leur avenir et donc ils doivent.
She says their peers from the war zone should be courageous as they prepare their future in their new schools. Last week, Cameroon said its military had launched rockets on at least 1,000 suspected Boko Haram fighters who attacked a military base in the border area of Amchide and seized a huge portion of Cameroon's town of Ashigasha and a number of villages. In a telephone interview with VOA, journalist Samuel Sawada, who is based in northern Cameroon, says the affected areas are being deserted by the residents.
Many schools in areas that border on Nigeria, from Lake Chad to the locality of Buha in the Maritanaga, have been closed down. People have deserted and are still deserting to find refuge in the hinterland. And the families that actually could afford it have transferred their children to safer areas in the hinterland.
Nigeria and Cameroon report that thousands of people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced by Boko Haram's five-year-old uprising to create an Islamic State in northern Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that report by Moki Edwin Kinzeka brings us to the end of our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Tasalli and Halik by Sharhabil.
حبيبتي ديما وكلك جاذبية حلوة حبيبتي ديما وكلك جاذبية وعيون جذابة تسحر نعسانة عسلية وعيون نعسانة تسحر نعسانة عسلية وملامح حبيبتي محلاها زندية.
We have been listening to Sharhabil with the song Tasalli and Halik. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.